So we've just done, well done, life, the life theme, and so I'm building the poster up here on the floor, and now we're going to skip to the rest theme, the theme of rest.
Before you go on, can you just tell me, I might have missed it, are these just streams that you say are undeniably evident? You know, where did these
particular seven come from?
Yeah, particular streams come from for you.
If we all wrote down what are the 10 top themes of Scripture,
yeah,
we'd all come up with a different 10, but about 6 or 7 or 8 of them would be pretty the same-ish. And so I looked at different themes and just figured that these are the ones that don't cross over. So I've picked out the 7 strongest themes that I can think of in the Bible that are not variations on a theme. They're actually, the theme of life is different from the theme of rest. And so it's an arbitrary selection. I'll talk about the arbitrariness of it later on as well.
Okay.
In the very last slide is going to cover that.
Big picture.
So, yeah. So we had the timeline across the top. Now we're doing theme number 2. That was the theme of life. Now we're doing the theme of drama, rest. And in the garden, the creation took 6 days, but the story took 7 days. Why? Because the seventh day was the pinnacle. The creation story is an ABC, ABCD chiasm. So there's the 3 pairs at the front, and then the climax is the Sabbath, the seventh day. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy. And on the seventh day, God rested from all of the work that he had done in creating the world. And so in the blessed seventh day, God rests. Rest is a kind of negative word for us. It's not doing something. But that's because we are under death. We have bodies with entropy, and we need rest in order to get up and function again. God has no entropy, so he's not tired. He doesn't need to rest because he's tired on the seventh day. He's resting on the seventh day because he's happy. And he started before day one because he was happy. And so he does the 6 days of creation, and on the seventh day he rests because he's happy, and he wants to enjoy and delight in everything that he's already made. And Adam and Eve lived with God in his Sabbath rest, in his enjoyment, in his delight. They lived in the days of his delight in the seventh day. And so they had rest. I'm getting all tricky and sticky. I don't know what it is. It might not be battery. It might be my phone. Didn't do it before. This is battery maybe.
Just a question while we're pausing. I've heard that Hebrew word being translated refreshed, which is not being tired. It's like you got done. You're like, oh, it's like the end of pastor's week when you might think, well, I'm not tired. I'm refreshed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's an energized word, not I'm worn out from this creating.
Yeah.
It's and higher than you started.
Yes, and our bodies need rest like collapse on a Sunday, but we also... In Deuteronomy, the Sabbath is unto God. It's not. We don't get a rest from God. We get a rest toward God, and so we're actually our rest. We're collapsing toward God. We're relaxing in His space, and He had that for Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve enjoyed the rest of God. And now, if a person is treacherous and they become a traitor and stab someone in the back, what rest do they have? Traitors can't have rest. There's no such thing. We are betrayers. We betrayed God. And so Adam and Eve are now... Are they at rest? Hiding in the trees? Hiding in our clothes? Of course not. There's nothing a traitor, a treacherous one, can do to have any rest. They're never at rest. They're doomed to restlessness because of their guilt. And so if a single human in all of human history is ever going to have rest in their relation to God, it's going to have to come from him, because there's no capacity in a traitor to find rest. But God took Abraham and brought him on a particular day to a particular place. This wasn't Mount Moriah. This is a different place. And he brought Abraham to a mountain. Here it is on the picture, on the left. You see he's on the top of the mountain there. And at the beginning of Abraham's call, God promises him that he will have rest, that I will give you rest in the land. You will have a secure dwelling. You will not be a tent dweller forever. You will have your own property. And all of your children will find rest in this land. And I will give you this land forever. You will no longer have to be a wanderer, always restless. And he took him to the top of the mountain and he said to him, I want you to look north and I want you to look south. I want you to look east and I want you to look west. Just before this, they'd gone to the top of the mountain and Lot and Abram's men had been quarrelling. And they said, our people are too many for each other, our herds are too big. And Abraham said, you choose, Lot. And Lot looked down at the Jordan Valley. Now back in those days, the Garden of the Israel used to be as greener than New Hampshire. Because it was, I'll talk to some more about that later. It was destroyed by wars where the attacking armies cut down every single tree to destroy the land, so that to destroy the hope of the people in besieged cities. This is the since Christ, and so all of the trees in Palestine were cut down as a military strategy. So now it's desert and it's kind of nasty, and the only good places are where it's irrigated. But back then it was green, green, green. And Lot looks over at the Jordan Valley from this highest place, and he sees that it looks like the Garden of Eden. And so he says, "I'll have that piece." And Abraham says, fine, go. And so Lot takes off. But Yahweh says to Abraham, now, he went east. You see that? I want you to look north, south, east, and west. Every single thing that you can see with your eye, you will inherit eternally. It's all yours. That is my promise. What about Lot? He got the land on the east. Well, what happened to Lot? God knew. And so Abraham has this promise. Later, this second story is the death of Sarah. And the death of Sarah gets an entire chapter in the Bible, which is a bit wacky. In fact, the burial of Sarah gets an entire chapter in the Bible. You're like, this is weird. This is Ephron the Hittite. And there's a meeting at the town gate, and Abraham says, I want you to sell me a burial plot for my wife. Now, Abraham owns no land. He's a wanderer, right? Tents, herds. And the Hittite, Ephron, says, you may bury your dead. Pick any of our tombs. Abraham says, no, I want the land. I want a piece of dirt to bury my wife. I want the field and the cave of Machpelah. That's what I want. And Ephron says, fine, you can have it. Just have it. Go for it. You can bury your dead. Go for it. And Abraham says, no. I want to buy with money the cave of Machpelah and this particular piece of dirt. Ephron then starts a Middle Eastern negotiation. And here's how a Middle Eastern negotiation goes. Well, the price of the land is 400 shekels, but that's between me and you as friends. The correct response is that Abraham says, oh, you've got to be kidding. This is not worth 50 shekels. This is just, you're just being rude. This is disgraceful. How can you? I'm not even interested. And then Ephron's supposed to say, well, look, this is very prime land and it's really valuable to me and I'm not going to sell it. There's no way I would go below 250. There's just not a chance I'd go below. And so they're going to do a Middle Eastern haggle, and they're going to end up at about 100 shekels, maybe less. So here's how the negotiation goes. And this is why the narrative, Genesis 24, the whole chapter is on this. You go, what is the Bible about? Ephron says, he starts off, he says, well, the land's worth 400 shekels, but what's that between friends? Abraham says, done. And he shells out 400 shekels, which is way, way stupid. Just insane amount of money. And then it details, before all of the Hittites, the deeds were written this piece of dirt belongs to Abraham. Now, I'm choking up because I'm going to tell you why he was an idiot. All of his life, all of Abraham's life, since he'd been given that vision, everywhere he went, he came back to the Oaks of Mamre. He came back to Hebron. And he came back to Kiriath Arba. And so he goes to Egypt for one part of his life, but he comes back. He goes to Beersheba, but he comes back. He goes to the north to rescue Lot, but he comes back. Always he's coming back to Kiriath Arba, Hebron, the Oaks of Mamre. You say, why is he coming back to? He's coming back to three different places. And all of his life, when God shows up for the feast with Sarah, going to get a baby in a year, I'm going to come back to this place next year, and you're going to have a son. God comes back to this place. Always this place, but it's three places. Well, as you get to the end of Genesis, the story of Abraham, it turns out that Kiriath Arba is the other name for Hebron. And the Oaks of Mamre are the plot of land. The plot of land, the cave of Machpelah. And he's saying, I'm going to be buried here. Because decades back, God promised that everything I could see from here is mine. And when my wife and I are dead, we're going to look over all our children forever. And so, Yahweh gives Abraham the rest that he has been longing for at the center of every single thing that his children will ever get. And he looked down from the top of the hill at them. And in that era, Sarah is supposed to be buried back in Haran, hundreds of miles north. Because if you're buried where you weren't born, then it says, you remember in the Bible it often says his bones were laid to rest with his fathers. Yeah? If you weren't buried where you were born, it meant that your spirit would wander restless for eternity because you were not restored to the bones of your fathers. You weren't in the family tomb. And so Sarai was born either in Haran or Ur, and she had to be buried with the land of her fathers. Otherwise, her spirit would wander endlessly. But God had promised Abraham that this is yours. This is where you will rest endlessly instead of being restless endlessly. And so he writes the biggest check because the promise came true. I got it. I got it. This is it. In the next scene, when we scoot forward to the time of the Exodus and the conquest.
I think you're loud enough, and that's just possible.
Okay.
Let's just cut it right now. Off.
Thank you.
Are we recording, though? Are we going to lose that?
No, that's all right. When the time comes of the Exodus and conquest, they go out of the land of Egypt. They've been there 400 years. None of them have ever seen Canaan. And God promises that I'm going to give you the land of Canaan. And here's what he says. In Deuteronomy 6:10-11, he says, "And when Yahweh your God brings you into the land he swore to your forefathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you, it's a land with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant, and you will eat and be full." And then in chapter 8, Deuteronomy, he says, "For Yahweh your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks and of water, of fountains and springs flowing out in the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones, in whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. And you shall eat, and you shall be full, and you shall bless Yahweh your God for all of the good land that he's giving you. And at the by the time they actually get there, in the book of Joshua, there are 11 chapters of tribal boundaries in the book of Joshua. You go, how boring can the Bible be? No, think about it. Go back. You've been 400 years outside of your place that Yahweh had promised to your forefathers. You've been 40 years in the wilderness, wondering when you'll get the home because of the punishment that your fathers have brought upon you. And then you finally get to the edge of the land against the Jordan River, which you can't cross. How on earth are we going to get across here? And then Yahweh says, and then in Deuteronomy here is the promise that every single thing that you can see, you're going to own everything. And the cities are already for you. You're going to move in. I'm going to send the hornet before you, and I'm going to drive out the inhabitants, and you will defeat them in every place. And then when they move in, they have to allocate the tribes to the lands. And so they have 11 chapters of God allocating the tribes to the land. Now, if you were an Israelite and you read that, you would not miss a word. Whenever you're in the Bible reading genealogies and boring tribal boundaries and stuff, never miss a word. Don't skip. Because you imagine what it would be like for the next 1,000 years for any Israelites to read those passages. You say, see that one? See that one? That's my grandfather. See that one? That's my land. This is my land. From the great rock of this to the edge of the river, across the brook to this, and then up to the top of the hill. This is ours. And when can we lose this land? Never, ever, ever. This is eternally vowed to be our land. Even if we go into slavery and we have to sell ourselves and we have to sell the land, we can't sell the land, we can only lease it. Because it's the land belongs to Yahweh. And he will never let it pass out of our family until all things are fulfilled. And so the long and arduous descriptions of land boundaries, if you let yourself read them and go through them with your mind, you realize that God has fulfilled the promises that he made 430 plus years ago to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, 500, 600 years back. He's fulfilled all of those promises that he's been making. And they're reading this going, it came true, it came true, it came true. I was here. This has come true. In the when we scoot next up to the time of the great kings, we have here a man who's sitting under a vine and a fig tree. And in the time of David and Solomon, there was so much wealth in Jerusalem that silver was cheap. And that all of the slavery that was happening would happen to non-Israelites. None of the Israelites did manual labor. They were that wealthy. Until Solomon started conscripting and doing his wacky stuff. And it said that it was so... Can we look in 1 Kings 4, I think it is? 1 Kings 4, 25...
The line you got in here, it says every man was wealthy and secured enough to retire to a lakeside golf estate as a millionaire. Page 46.
That's right.
Well, scripture reference, yeah, but I'm claiming that promise. Hey.
Most of the promises of scripture are not for you. They're for Jesus, for you. So, hang in there.
So
where am I for?
Singing, every promise in the book of mine, throw that out of your book, right?
Absolutely. No, that's true in Jesus.
Yeah.
So Jesus inherits all the promises. What am I saying? 40, what verse was it? 4:25. So this is about the rule of Solomon, the breadth of his wealth and wisdom. He had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tifsa to Gaza, all over all the kings of the west of the Euphrates, and he had peace on all sides around him, and Judah and Israel lived in safety. From Dan in the north, even to Beersheba in the south, every man under his vine and under his fig tree all the days of Solomon. Now, if you're in an agricultural society, what does it mean that you live under your own vine and fig tree? Every man lives under his own vine and fig tree.
Self-sufficiency, you've got everything you'd ever need right there.
You've got the generator, you've got the barbecue, you've got everything you need because you're in your own land, you're not leased out, and your own land has a vine and a fig tree, that you have your oil, your wine, everything you need.
Which kind of oil now?
That was olive oil there.
Yeah, nowadays it's, you got to oil well.
So this is a picture where God is showing off, and he's saying, what I made come true for the Israelites, made come true for one block of land with Abraham, now I made it come true for the whole people, and now I've made it come true for the entire nation, that you have total security. Your rest reaches from Gaza to the Euphrates. There is no military threat under Solomon's reign. They are totally at rest. They're in their own cities with their own cisterns, and each man has their own property back. It's heaven on earth, because Yahweh has proven all of his promises have come true. Can someone please look out Joshua verse 21, chapter 21, verse 43. And just call it out when someone gets it, Joshua 21, 43. This is back in the time of Joshua.
So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their forefathers, and they took possession of it and settled there.
Next verse.
The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their forefathers. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord handed all their enemies over to them. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to the house of Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled.
You read that last line again. Not one.
Not one of the promises the house of Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled.
So from the promises to Abraham, who never saw a piece of land that was promised to him, owned by him until the death of his wife, then all of the people have all of the promises of the land all fulfilled. And now in the time of the kings, it's so fulfilled that their conquest is from Euphrates to Egypt, and their rest is secure, and everybody's got their own vine and fig tree. In the time of the Psalms literature, the Lord is my shepherd. This is a psalm of rest. There's lots of psalms of rest. The Lord's my shepherd, I shall not want. He leads me beside green pastures, the still waters. On his path he quiets my soul. I have rest. He leads me with rod and staff. He prepares a table before me, even in the presence of my enemies. My security is like that. He anoints my head with oil. My cup is overflowing. And I will dwell forever in the house of the Lord. So the Psalms have all these stories about how Yahweh is the God of rest, who brings rest and provides rest. Here he's providing rest to David, his king, in the midst of his enemies, in the place of Jerusalem. And then if we go to the time of the prophets, we start as soon as Solomon's son Rehoboam destroys the kingdom. Solomon destroys the kingdom, Rehoboam consummates it. The prophets then talk about rest in heart terms and in supernatural terms. And they'll look back at the rest of Exodus, but they'll say, that was nothing. Let's see what's happening. There's going to come a king, and this is a mixture of prophecies, they're all in the book. There's going to come a king, he's going to be of the tribe of... The B should be a star, I think it is in your book. He's going to be of the tribe of David, he's going to be a son of David, a David king. He's going to be a shepherd of his people Israel, he's going to take care of the sheep, give them rest. He's going to be a prince of peace. He's going to actually rule with peace. And he's going to declare, if you're a military general, you ride in on your horse and you declare war on your stallion. This king is going to declare peace riding in on a donkey. He's going to conquer the world with peace. This king is going to bring about a kingdom so radical that the wolf and the lamb will be together and no harm will come on his holy mountain. So the prophets, as usual, seem to be smoking something, but they are saying, I have to give you images and metaphors that transcend normal categories. They transcend normal human thought and normal human grammar. And so there's this king coming, there's one who's going to come who is peace. Your rest, your peace is going to come in flesh. And so
what's that be?
Back, that's an old slide. I've had to replace everything so there's no language in it so I can go to other cultures. So I had to get rid of letters, alpha stuff. It was blessing. It's one of the prophecies about the blessing of rest. Next one. Now, in the time of the remnant, when the remnant come back from Babylon, Nehemiah comes back. He sneaks around in the middle of the night studying the wall. Remember, he does that midnight cruise to study the state of the wall, and then he gathers all the folks around. Now, in the Middle East, back in those days, your wall was your rest. If there's a threat, everybody in the fort closes the door and you can survive for ages. Nebuchadnezzar had the largest army on earth and it took him 2 years to get through the wall in Jerusalem. That's how important it is to have a wall, because your wall is your security, is your rest. And when he got through, he destroyed the place, tore the walls down because of his rage at them holding out on him inside a fort for 2 years against the greatest army on earth. And he destroyed the wall. So Nehemiah is coming back 70, 80 years later, studying the walls and seeing how bad it is, and then he appoints every family to build a piece of the wall. There's a lot of the Nehemiah story about, and then we build this piece, and then we build that piece, and you go, oh, this is boring. No, read it. Go there. Imagine the families are having to build with one hand, with a sword in their other hand, because of the menace of the armies, of the neighbors. And the neighbors are busy writing to Xerxes, to Cyrus. Who was it then? Cyrus or Xerxes, to try and get him to shut them down. And there's murder plots. They arrange a meeting with Nehemiah, and Yahweh warns him, say, don't do it, they're going to kill you. That's what the plan is. And finally, the day they get the wall together, the entire community get on the top of the wall, and they get into two groups, and they march around making the biggest noise they possibly can, celebrating with trumpets and music and the biggest feast out, because they have finally been given rest after their 70 years of exile, where they lost the land, they lost their temple, they lost their city. And here it is, Yahweh has given them rest. They lost it because of their sin, and they got it back because Yahweh did it. Oh, by the way, who paid for all this? A foreign emperor. Because Yahweh likes doing that. Remember the Pharaoh, he gets his daughter to save the Israelites. So the next one. Then comes Jesus, he says, come to me. I am the location of rest. I am the GPS location of rest in this universe. It's not going to be the land anymore. It's not going to be the fact that you'll have a fence and a wall. It's not going to be that your enemies outside in Babylon or Assyria are going to be destroyed. Your enemies of sin and hell and death and Satan, they're the ones I destroy, and I give you God's Sabbath rest. And so he now becomes the theme that was lost in the garden and then just keeps on being given back to his children. And so for us, we move to the time of the church. There's a story in Hebrews where it says that we have this hope, the hope of security and rest and the hope of atonement in heaven. And it is the anchor for our soul. And it reaches through the veil into where Jesus has gone. So no matter how much turmoil and madness and unrest there is in our lives, it matters not, because our anchor is now permanently secured in heaven. We have this hope as an anchor in heaven, firm and secure beyond the veil. And so we have this eternal rest that the Israelites only knew was coming. They had it economically and geographically and militarily. It's no longer that. Now it's inside the human heart. So the rest goes wherever we go in our restless lives. And finally, at the end of the story, we're finally going to get a city with walls. Remember that phrase? The city with walls, whose architect and builder is God. It's made of gold. We'll finally have eternal rest and security. All its foundations are going to be of precious jewels, gems. And there will be no more sea, because in the ancient world the sea represented Rahab, the sea monster. And the sea is the motif of restlessness, because the sea never stops. It's always doing this. There's no rest. And so it doesn't mean there's no surfing in heaven. It means that there is no sea. There is no. It's code. It's code. There's no more restlessness. There is no more sin. We're free from sin. We can finally put our guard down and not be afraid of sin. Not be afraid of someone else sinning against us. There'll be no more tears, because God will wipe away all tears from all eyes, including his own. There'll be no more pain, and there'll be no more death. We'll no longer be afraid of death. We can finally rest and be at peace. Because what we forfeited as traitors in the garden, the rest that was given to us by God before the fall, Yahweh has restored to his children eternally. Thus says the Lord. Please turn to page number 53 and see if you can get two or three dot points to those two questions or three questions there. Maybe one dot point under each one. We'll just go silent for a minute a bit. Let's briefly just trade some good things with each other. So what are the things that are coming to your mind? What did you jot down? What did you chat about? Let's trade some across the room. So one.
One real quick right there. Just had the funeral in Brooklyn for my wife's great aunt. And that's exactly what we talked about. 104 years old. She was waiting a long time to get to that heavenly rest. And that's exactly what we talked about. No more sin, no more tears, no more pain, no more death. She finally got there. She had to wait a long time.
Yep.
I immediately went to my mind to Isaiah 49. I love this.
Tell us.
This passage. All of a sudden, he's talking about all this restoration that's going to come, and there's this movement of amazing completion that's going to happen, salvation. The end of the earth, new heaven, new earth, everything, and then, you know, verse 14 says, "But Zion said, the Lord's forsaken me, my Lord's forgotten me." And then the Lord chimes back in and says, "Can a woman forget her nursing child that she should have no compassion on the soul of him? Even they should make forget, and I will not forget. Behold, I have engraved on the palms of my hands your walls are continually before me."
Yeah.
This idea of rest, that this is, and it's going to come through, you know, through his pierced hands.
Yeah. Yes, he's graven us.
Rest.
Our theology has always been big on the finished work of Christ. Mm-hmm. But it's so hard to rest in that because of our nature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think one day we'll just go, that's it. Resting in his finished work.
One day we'll be done with the squirrel.
Yeah.
What other things are standing out as you look at the rest theme fold out layer by layer?
Rest is a gift. We think it's, you know, we work hard today and we'll rest good tonight. We think we've earned a good rest, but this rest is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
I think what Hebrews says, in light of what you just said, where it says in Hebrews 1, where Jesus sat down.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the work is done. It's finished. Nothing more has to be added.
Yeah. The high priest never sat down.
Yeah, that's right. There's no seat then.
No, the seat was for God.
Yes.
And so Jesus is the high priest. I've done now.
Yeah.
I've sat down.
Beautiful.
I live here.
Think of all that slaughtering that went on and how exhausting and horrible that was.
Yeah. All the showers.
Yeah.
It's much more sense of accomplishment now.
Than napping.
This was Todd's point. It's not so much about taking a nap as it is true accomplishment of the work being done.
Mm. Okay.
Although napping is nice.
Yes. Yes.
It's on the schedule this afternoon.
Okay. Going once. Going twice. Yeah.
As you've been going through this, just that it's God's story, and as I watch the TV, what's happening in the Middle East and Syria and all of that, the rest for me comes in that this is God's story, and he has it well in control, and he knows what's going to happen. It's his story, he's written it, and I can rest in that this is his story, and he has a happily ever after ending. He knows that. Mm-hmm. And we have to partake in that and really take seriously to get his story out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I appreciated Pastor Pat's message last night. I left here restful and greater freedom.
So with the question, well, what's our part in getting this rest? The correct answer is, that's funny. So.
Well, if I was a Jew, not knowing that Jesus is my rest, I'd be pissed off.
Mm.
I mean, my land.
Where's the Messiah? Where's my land?
Where's my land?
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah, yeah. All the end times literature is pretty much grisly terrible, because there's all this thinking about that finally Jerusalem will be retaken, there'll be a temple again, there'll be the priesthood and so on, and nothing worse could ever happen. That would be the worst thing on earth. Because can you imagine re-establishing the temple and the priesthood and the sacrifices, i.e. that Jesus' finished work is actually now not finished and we can start it again? And so Christians being excited about retaking Jerusalem is the most heretical, vomitorious thing. And what a terrible...
Are you a Lutheran?
Yeah.
I'm in shock.
And the whole... It's all a power fantasy. It's all a power fantasy. I will be one of the special ones that gets to have a geographical association with the new kingdom of God on earth. I'll be one of them. I'll be able to travel to Jerusalem because I'm a rich white Westerner and I can buy tickets. And, you know, this is coming true in our time. And I think that Russia and Syria and Bible, they've been fighting forever. It's no different. Let's stop. Okay.